Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday morning, the 2nd of December. Healthcare this hour, and particularly the public option. Our guest writes in the New York Times, November 29, in an op-ed piece, as the healthcare debate enters its decisive stage, liberals in Congress should be ready to trade the public option for provisions that will actually make the reforms succeed. Joining us this hour is Professor Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public affairs, and he is at Princeton University. He's co-editor of The American Prospect. He is the author of Freedom's Power, The History and Promise of Liberalism, and he worked in the Clinton administration as a senior healthcare policy analyst. The Hill is reporting yesterday that a new measure on the public option will be unveiled next week, which Senate Democratic leaders hope will break the logjam on healthcare reform. Senator Tom Carper from Delaware was tapped by Majority Leader Henry Reid to come up with a Plan B approach to the public option controversy. We talk about all of this with our guest, not only our guest, but also with you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you're so welcome to do that. That's talk@wpr.org. Professor Paul Starr, hi. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's good to be with you, Kathleen.
Yeah, it should be a really good discussion. All right. Liberals should be willing, and I think it looks like they are going to be willing, to trade the public option for provisions that will make the reform succeed. What are the most important parts of the reform, do you think, that, because a lot of people have said public option is it. If it's not public option, it's nothing. What's more important than public option?
Well, the public option that the Senate is considering would cover less than 2% of the population, and it would probably have higher premiums than private insurance offered in the new insurance exchanges that would be set up under the reform. So my view is that it is really crazy to say that this is make or break for the legislation. This is a reform that would give more than 30 million people who don't have coverage insurance coverage. It would raise the standards of coverage for many millions more people. It would do many other things that would help bring costs under control in the long run. It has been so difficult to make any progress on this issue for years and years. Mm-hmm. So if people aren't willing to compromise, we could end up again with nothing. And there are other things in the bill that I think liberals should focus on that could be improved either in the Senate or when it comes to a conference between the Senate and the House. And I think really keeping your eye on those other provisions would really pay off more in the long run.
Do you think that both the Senate and the House bills do a great deal to regulate private insurers?
The House bill does a lot more than the Senate bill, and that is one of my major concerns about the Senate bill. The Senate bill leaves most of the regulation to the states. And many of the states have had a terrible history of health insurance regulation. They get captured by the insurance industry. We're much more likely to have that regulation work if it's done at the federal level. Now, the House bill does provide for states to set up their own exchanges if they step forward and they meet federal requirements. But the House bill sets the priority as getting things in motion, and this is really crucial. The Senate bill has got all sorts of sources of potential delay, and it could be years and years and years before the Senate bill is carried out because it leaves it to the states. It means that not only do we have to get this legislation through Congress, which is incredibly difficult, for the Senate bill to work, you've actually got to get similar legislation through 50 state legislatures. And there are many states where I wonder whether this would really happen. The states would be recalcitrant. The law might never really be carried out there. So the House bill has, you know, sort of as the default condition, the federal government's going to go ahead, it's going to bring about these changes, and if you, a particular state, want to step in and undertake this, okay. But it's going to move ahead regardless.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said that it's so difficult to make any progress, which is so true and maybe an understatement here. What in the world makes it so difficult to have any kind of change here? Because it seems to me as though a lot of people would agree, going back to this 80% of us agree that these are the things that need to happen. Republicans and Democrats and independents and everybody is being affected by this. So why is it so hard to make progress?
That's a long story. Americans have been fighting over this issue for just about a century. And the issue has changed over the years. The sources of opposition have changed. It's become much more complicated for a variety of reasons. I mean, this healthcare is now one-sixth of our economy. There are enormous interests involved. Back, let's say, at the time that Harry Truman proposed national health insurance, at that time we spent, about 3 or 4% of national income on healthcare. And Harry Truman said, well, we're going to insure everybody. It's going to cost some more money. And that was the view up through the 60s and 70s. Then healthcare costs got out of control. Both in the private and the public sector. And healthcare reform became not only a matter of extending coverage to the people who didn't have it, it also became a matter of controlling costs. And combining those two missions together, extending coverage and controlling costs, is just inherently difficult, and people are skeptical. They think, if you're going to extend coverage, how could you possibly keep costs down? And they worry that if you're going to extend coverage to other people, and you're going to keep costs down, that, hey, maybe I'm going to lose out in the end.
Right.
And so you get a lot of anxieties created by this. It is such a shame that we didn't make these changes many years ago, when healthcare was a much smaller economic concern, the way it is in most other countries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we now spend 16% of our economy, of our national income on healthcare. And the average for other rich countries in the world, the rich Western European countries, is only 9%. And they're healthier than we are. So how is it that we spend all this extra money and yet we don't end up better off? And that is something that is, it's so difficult to convince people that we could make changes that would improve conditions for Americans and we could actually end up in the long run, spending less money.
And what is it? Is it politicians who don't want reform, who are quite adept at getting people to believe that they, I think what you said is really true, that people believe they're going to lose out some way, and indeed they probably aren't going to lose out, but somebody's telling them that they are, and they're believing that person.
Yes, well, I think this has become an example of how polarized and partisan our politics have become. If you go back now to the 1940s and 50s and 60s and 70s, there were Republicans who proposed plans for expanding health coverage, indeed for universal coverage. Richard Nixon proposed a plan for national health insurance that was to the left of anything the Democrats are proposing now. And there were many other Republicans over the years who favored proposals that look very much like the proposals Democrats are talking about. That is, proposals to subsidize the purchase of private insurance, which is really the main focus of this bill, whether or not there's a public option. So it's really extraordinary that that's so changed. I mean, there just is no Republican support, except for Olympia Snow, perhaps, no Republican support for any measure that would extend coverage to the uninsured. It's really tragic that we have reached this point where the polarization has become so extreme.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think many Republicans feel they defeated Bill Clinton in 1993-94, and they swept the elections in 94. They benefited from humiliating a new Democratic president on what was his top domestic priority. And I think they're trying to do the same thing with Barack Obama.
What do you make of this report Maybe it's elsewhere today. I was just looking at the web this morning from reported on the Hill that a new measure on the public option is going to be unveiled next week. Senator Tom Carper tapped by Reid to come up with a Plan B approach to the public option controversy. Carper acknowledging that the opt-out public option bill doesn't have the votes necessary, so now we're looking perhaps at a you need a trigger. If things are really bad, then you're going to have a trigger. What do you think of this strategy?
Oh, I think that might be an excellent idea. First of all, I want a bill to get through the Senate so they can get to Senate House Conference, and then they can make deals there. So the first thing is to find some kind of compromise to get 60 votes in the Senate. By the way, this is a hurdle that legislation did not have to meet in decades past. There wasn't this constant use of the filibuster that demanded a supermajority for every piece of legislation getting through the Senate. But that is the reality we face now. They need 60 votes. There are only 60 Democrats, well, actually 58 Democrats and two independents, and that's going to be the criterion. I hope they come up with some formula that can keep Bernie Sanders on board on the left, and that can somehow also keep some of these blue dog Democrats on board, something to satisfy them all. And I would be delighted if that were a trigger of some kind. Actually, a trigger might not be such a bad proposal at all. If you could have a trigger with a stronger public option, that would be something worth talking about. What worries me about the public option in the bill is that it's really been so watered down, it's so weak, it's really not going to do what its supporters hope. And so if you had a trigger with a strong public option, that's really worth talking about.
Right. You, in your article in the Times, talked about how long it's going to take for these measures to become law. Senate bill looking at 2014, that seems like 100 years away at this point in time. Why is it that these won't kick in until much later? And wouldn't it make sense for at least some reform, even politically speaking, to kick in fairly soon?
Yes. Well, this is one of the things I have been writing about for a while. The House bill has 2013 as the date for the establishment of the new insurance exchanges and the extension of coverage through both the subsidies for insurance and the expansion of Medicaid. And then the Senate pushed back even further to 2014. Now, there are some short-term measures in these bills, and they are actually quite good. They are some reforms that would immediately end some of the worst abuses in the insurance industry. For example, rescissions, situations where companies refuse, take away insurance once somebody gets sick. That's just outrageous, and Congress would deal with that sooner rather than later. The legislation would enable young adults up to age 26 to stay on their parents' insurance policy. I've got some kids just in that age range. That's a great thing from many families' point of view. So there are a number of things like that that do kick in sooner. But the big expansion of coverage they put off until 2014, and I think that is a huge mistake. It means, for example, that Barack Obama would have to run for re-election in 2012 defending a program from which people have seen relatively little benefit.
Yes.
And it doesn't make sense to me politically. It also is basically giving the opponents two elections to undo whatever Congress does now. And that really could mean that they pass the legislation and people would never see the benefit of it. So I think they need to move up those dates. Now, the reason that they have put things off that much is, frankly, that they're trying to improve the fiscal appearances so that, they calculate costs over a 10-year period. Well, if you don't start running the costs until the fifth year, obviously the costs are going to look relatively lower. I think they have to face up to the fact that they need to pay for those costs, and they should accelerate the development of the program. And one way that I suggest doing this is to let states come in more quickly. if a state is willing to move ahead faster to set up one of these insurance exchanges, to comply with other federal rules, then provide, let's have the law provide them the money to do that. And then maybe we could see quite a few states move ahead on a faster schedule. And that would also demonstrate to the country as a whole that this can work.
So it's not a matter of this system is so complicated it's going to take us 3 years to get it in order?
No, I don't think so. I mean, remember that Medicare went into effect 1 year after it was enacted. There are some additional complications here because of the idea of setting up these insurance exchanges in 50 different states. It probably would require more than a year. I think 2 years should be enough. I actually worked on this problem when I was at the White House in 1993, and I know there are a lot of bureaucratic obstacles to doing this, and Congress has to write into the law an accelerated process for writing the regulations. They need to speed everything up in order to prevent everything from just getting dragged out for years and years.
We're going to phone calls for you, Paul. We'll start in a minute. Our number is 800-486-8655. And many of you may have seen the article, Fighting the Wrong Healthcare Battle, that Paul wrote in the New York Times on November 29. Paul is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, an author, and for purposes of our conversation, most pertinent in his bio. He was a senior health policy advisor in the Clinton administration. He's up on all that's being discussed in the Senate and the House, the two bills, and the fact, one of the central things that he wrote about in the article in the Times is that the public option has been so watered down that it doesn't mean all that much anymore. And instead, the liberal members of the House and the Senate ought to make sure that a new plan through insurance exchanges it needs to be very strong, and that the private insurance companies need to be regulated, that we don't want to sacrifice what may be a very good plan to preserve a public option. Okay. Oh, yeah, your phone call. Did I give you the number? I forget. I do it kind of by rote because you got to do it all the time. 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to send one of those, is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tonight, NPR has a special on President Obama's decision regarding troop levels in Afghanistan. It will be from 6 until 7 tonight. Linda Werthmeyer will be the host. She will have a number of guests, and they'll have clips from various people who are appearing on Capitol Hill today, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Secretary of Defense, and the Secretary of State. Two phone calls now, and let us start with David from Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
I'm big on health care. I had a brother who died because of lack of health care. Mm. I have a real simple amendment for the health care. I think would do a lot. We want your guest to comment on it, what he thinks about it. Okay. It is same policy, same price. That would mean it would essentially make the whole United States one group exchange. It also means small employers would pay the same price large employers do. It would mean no discrimination because of age, sex, physical condition. You get this if you buy the same policy, you get the same price. And it would also allow them to advertise the prices on the radio. And I think it would work, and it would be real simple. It's just a simple rule that if I'm an insurance company, I put a policy that covers this, this, and this, I set a price to it, and whoever comes to can buy it.
Okay. I've got good news for you. That is really the direction in which the legislation is moving. And that is exactly what would happen in the statewide insurance exchanges. Insurers would offer what's called a community rate, the same rate, to everyone in the exchange. And now the exchanges would start out with Everyone who's in what's called the individual market, who buys insurance individually, and with employees of small businesses, actually up to 100 employees in the Senate bill. And so all of those people, and I think nationally that comes to something like 30 million. I'm not sure of that figure. I may have that wrong. But in each state, they would be able to choose among a variety of different insurance plans that are offered through the exchange. And there would be an annual enrollment, as there is in, you know, many employers. And they'd face the same price. Now, there is a provision for some variation according to age. And that has been a subject of much debate. And the reason is that if you don't allow for some variation by age, you're going to end up charging a lot to young people. And one of the problems I think we have in achieving universal coverage is that a lot of young people don't feel they need health insurance. And so they would particularly object to paying for a policy that's relatively expensive. So there is some age grading. There is some allowance for differences in age. But otherwise, it's the same price for everybody in the exchange.
Thanks, David, for your call. We go to Brad next. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. I heard Howard Dean mention that insurance companies won't be able to deny people enrollment due to pre-existing conditions, but will be able to charge those folks up to twice as much in premiums.
No. No, that's not right.
My question for you is, will all types of health insurance companies no longer be able to underwrite people, including Medicare supplement companies? Or does this piece of reform only apply to the exchange?
Okay, now, on Medicare supplements, I don't believe there's any change. But the policies that we're talking about apply to the insurance exchanges, and they also apply to, it depends whether they're talking about the Senate or the House bill now. They also apply to some policies that might be sold outside the exchange. And the objective here is to create a single risk pool. Okay, so that is a large number of people, a large population, where there is no variation in charges for insurance according to your health. So I don't know where you heard Howard Dean saying that, but that's not true. Insurance policies would be offered regardless, with the same price, regardless of your prior health condition. That would not affect the price. Now, that's, of course, why there has to be some requirement to cover, to bear insurance, to pay for insurance, what's called an individual mandate. Because if we just eliminated the pre-existing condition exclusion, but let people buy insurance whenever they wanted and not buy it whenever they wanted, then it would be rational only to buy insurance when you're sick.
Sure.
And in that case, the whole thing breaks down.
Right. Thank you very much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Could you explain, Paul, because I think this has been confusing to a lot of people, what's happening with Medicare? A lot of seniors are worried that their benefits are going to be decreased, and I'm wondering what both bills have to say about Medicare, if anything.
Well, the major benefit that the elderly will see is that there is going to be an expansion of coverage under Medicare Part D, under the prescription drug coverage, a reduction in what's called the donut hole, that area in the middle where people don't get coverage. And this is one of this is actually going to happen pretty soon. I think that's like within a year of the bill's enactment. So they get that fast. And this is the reason that the AARP has been supporting the legislation, that the elderly are going to see a big benefit. Now, there is a cut in the bill in the payments to private insurers under Medicare, which the Republicans instituted some years ago, when they controlled the Congress.
Yes.
And there's a lot of evidence that that these payments to private insurers under Medicare have been excessive. They've been making huge profits off Medicare, and they're actually costing a lot more than traditional Medicare. So there's a very good justification for making those cuts.
And how many seniors have those kinds of plans?
I don't have that figure right off the top of my head. I seem to remember something in the order of 20-25%.
Really? Let's go next to Sonny from Eau Claire. Hello, Sonny.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going to try to make this as quick as possible. First of all, this is not a simple bill. 2,074 pages is not simple. And, you know, I believe we do need health care reform. We can start with tort reform and utilizing the laws to punish those that break the laws instead of trying to layer new laws on top of laws. That's just complicating the system. As far as the trigger, no, please, no. No public option. We need to start phasing out these entitlements so people can afford to get what they need.
How do we...
Let's face it, you know... I've been an NPR listener and a public radio listener for a long time, and the government is very wasteful. We get back approximately 12%. The government keeps about 88%, and they waste it through corruption, expanding their own offices, et cetera, et cetera. So if you want to make this more successful, allow people to have their money instead of taking it in taxes.
Well, look, I mean, you're certainly entitled to your view, but really there's almost nothing more wasteful than the current private insurance system that we have. And as for not giving your money back, private insurers are pretty good at doing that. Out of every dollar that people in the who buy insurance individually, out of every dollar they pay in premiums, they only get back about 60 to 70 cents in healthcare, because that market, that private market that you like so much, that private market is so phenomenally inefficient. In fact, we spend in the United States far more on bureaucratic overhead in the private sector for health insurance than do other countries spend for their government insurance systems. And I wish I could show you all the data on that. It just contradicts everything that you assume. But instead of approaching this with some fixed ideas, it would be great if you spent some time finding out about the facts.
Thanks very much for the call. We go next to Maria from Madison. Hello, Maria.
Hi.
Hi.
I guess I definitely the polar opposite of the fellow who just called you. I have pretty much the exact opposite feeling. Healthcare is an inelastic. I think it's economically inconsistent to apply free market principles to something that everybody needs. And saying that the free market, the hand of the free market and allowing insurance companies to compete across state lines and things like that is going to fix the system, well, that just opens more loopholes for insurance companies to go to the state with the least regulation and operate from there with, it's basically the lowest common denominator. So I guess I'm pretty frustrated with the whole idea of the exchange and everything. I mean, I understand it's a long ways to go from the system we have now to anything like a public option and even especially a single payer. But healthcare is something that everybody needs, and comparing how much we pay for healthcare compared to the services that we get. You compare the U.S. to other developed countries, and it's really, that says, I guess, everything that I'm getting at.
What do you want? Single payer, Maria, or?
I'm one of the liberals that you were talking about earlier who has to compromise on the public option. I definitely think that single payer would be ideal. I mean, it's working pretty well in other countries. It's not perfect, but I think it's much, much better than what we have here.
Professor Starr.
If we were back in 1965 when Congress was enacting Medicare, I would agree with you and say it would have been much better if we just had a national health insurance system that covered everybody. We have gone so far down this road that it is very difficult to unwind all that has been done, all the institutions that have been built, all the assumptions that have grown up. It's now one-sixth of our economy. It's extremely difficult to change. And it's not just a matter of making compromises. It's genuinely difficult to move these institutions in a new direction without creating some kind of real problems, real crisis. So it's a huge challenge. That's why this legislation ends up being so complicated. It's trying to address so many different interests that have grown up, and legitimate interests that have grown up. We're trying to work with what we've got. The exchanges, I think, are the best option that we have. They would enable people to make choices among different health plans. I do think there is some benefit to that. I don't really believe that this is any kind of free market. It's a system of consumer choice, but there's a lot of regulation that needs to be there in order for those choices really to get people what they want. because healthcare is so complicated, health insurance is so complicated, people can't be expected really to know all the fine print. That's why, for example, we need standardized benefit packages so that actually the price comparisons would be meaningful. If you don't have standardized benefit packages, people really have no basis for comparing one plan to another. There are just too many complicated provisions. So we're trying, as I said, we're trying to work with what we've got, trying to provide for some consumer choice, trying to move these institutions a little bit ahead, actually quite significantly ahead. I mean, if we can cover 30 to 40 million people who don't have health insurance today, that is a tremendous advance for this country.
Thank you very much for the call, Maria. Our number is 800-486-8655. Give me your best guess as to where all of this is going. Will we have a bill by the end of this month? Will we see something very different than what we're seeing now, the bill in the Senate, the bill in the House? Or will the whole thing fall apart?
You know, we have every reason to believe that if the Democratic Party can hold together its ranks, the Senate will approve a bill. But there are wavering senators on both the left and the right side, and it is conceivable that it will break down. This is an impossible thing to predict, because one single senator could throw the entire thing off. But I think what they recognize is that their fate hangs on this bill. This is going to be the basis on which this Congress is judged, and they've spent months and months on it. They've made it the major focus of this Congress, and if they fail to do something in the end, it will be seen as a colossal failure.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they must get something through. I think they recognize they must get something through, and I think we should expect that in the end they will. But there are, as I said, a single vote could block the way.
Right. And will this also be the basis on which this president is judged, or will that be Afghanistan now?
That's hard to say. I think first of all, the American people are going to judge the president on the basis of the economy as a whole. And come 2012, that is going to be a decisive factor in the election. But I think health care could matter a great deal, too. If this is something that ultimately gets accomplished, it's going to look very important, I think, especially in historical perspective, given how many other presidents have tried and failed.
We go next to Sandy from Lake Geneva. Hi, Sandy.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a situation where we have no insurance. My husband works for a small company, doesn't provide it. I've been a stay-at-home mom for many years, raising the kids. We've I've looked into insurance over the years, and the cost, the premium, is just completely prohibitive for us. If we're required to have insurance, might as well send the cops to our house and throw us in jail because we're not going to be able to afford it.
Well, that is probably true under the present system. The difference is that these reforms would provide a subsidy that would limit your costs. So now I don't know what your family income is, and besides, even if you told me, I wouldn't be able to calculate what the subsidy would be on, you know, right now. I don't have that ability to do that sort of thing. But the Senate bill limits the cost to the consumer for a standard policy. It depends on your income. At the lower end, it limits it to, I don't know, 2 or 3% of income. And at the upper end, when the subsidies trail off, it goes up to about 9% of income. And the subsidies trail off at 4 times the poverty level. So, if your income is somewhere in between there, the cost to you of insurance coverage might be at, I don't know, 5%, 6% of your income. And my guess is that's a lot less than what you're looking at now.
And she must have an underlying fear that they're going to have to meet major medical expenses. That's living on the edge, which nobody should have to do, Paul.
Uh-huh. Yes.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about health care reform this hour. Our guest wrote a piece, if you want to go online and get it now. It's well worth a read. November 29, New York Times, Fighting the Wrong Healthcare Battle. And it is written by our guest, Paul Starr, Professor of Sociology, Public Affairs, Stewart Professor of Communications and Public Affairs at Princeton University. He also was a senior health policy advisor in the Clinton administration. Email talk at WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tonight at 6 o'clock, National Public Radio is presenting a news special on President Obama's decision regarding troop levels in Afghanistan. You'll be able to hear excerpts from appearances on Capitol Hill today by the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, by the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State. Linda Wertheimer will be joined in the studio by NPR political and national security correspondents tonight, 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls, 800-486-8655. Roger is calling from Toma. Oh, Roger, it's a little noisy. Hi.
Hi, this is Roger from Toma.
Hi, Roger.
How are you both today?
All right, Roger. How are you?
Good. You know what I think? I think that, the insurance that the government employees get, the Congress, the House, it should be given to everyone. And then what they should do is have everyone pay from when they're 18 or 21, when they're young, all the way up until they're, they die. With an equal amount, maybe $100 with start and $100 to when you die, or $200, whatever it may be, or a percentage, 2% to 8%, But if everyone pays going in from when they're young all the way to when they're older, then all that money, if you're not using it when you're young, can get paid towards people when they get older, almost like a little Social Security plan, but a little bit added onto your paycheck in that percentage or that straight flat amount. Federal, state, Social Security, and health insurance. But I believe everybody should have it on their own individually, not through any company, because this way you can take it and do whatever you like with it. And, I'm driving, so I just might cut in and out. So I would like to take my answer off the phone, please.
Yeah, that would be fine. I'd feel better about that, too, okay. So you can keep driving. Professor Starr.
Well, I think a lot of people want to move in a direction that Roger is talking about. However, at the moment, we have millions of people who are getting insurance through their employer, and many of those people are happy with their coverage. They don't want to change, and it would be very disruptive to force them to change in the short run. The insurance exchanges that we're talking about are really a mechanism to do what Roger wants in the long run, because if you get your insurance through the exchange, then you can just move from job to job, and your insurance will not be affected by that. The employer would make a contribution into the exchange, and you would pay some additional amount to pick the plan that you want. So I think we're going in that direction, and also in the direction of everybody contributing. That was, that's the point that we were just discussing a moment ago with a woman who said that she and her family can't afford insurance. Well, the idea is to provide a subsidy so that they can afford it, but it does mean that everybody has to contribute.
Thanks, Roger. Gary from De Pere. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, I've had that Michael Moore movie home three times now, sicko, and I'm also insured by my employer for health insurance, and you do get lots of bills for deductibles and co-insurance. It's no panacea for your employer. Also, my mother's on Medicare. If you don't have a Medigap policy worth about $2,000 to $4,000 a year, you will go to bankruptcy court for the 20% that it's not insured by Medicare. You would think people would be screaming for a single-payer system, let alone employers would scratch their head every year to buy a new policy.
Well, I think what you're responding to is just that the American healthcare system has become so phenomenally expensive. Nationally, the average family health policy costs about $13,000. And that's just an enormous amount of money for many people. Now, a lot of employed people don't realize how much their employer is contributing to the plan. They only see their own share. They don't realize just how expensive health insurance and health care have become in the United States. And that is where we are. We are trying to provide protection for people so they don't go bankrupt. But we can't cover all those costs. There are going to be copays. There are going to be deductibles. People are going to have to bear some of the of that cost. There's just no way around that.
Thanks very much, Gary. Roger from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
And I just believe unless we really have strong auditing and regulation mechanisms, the private insurers are just going to find specious excuses for raising costs. Insurers are cartels already, and that's how cartels operate. They took a lead from OPEC, I think, years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I think people have good reason to be skeptical about private insurers. Many of them have operated on a really unconscionable basis, trying to cherry-pick the healthy, trying to avoid sick people, dropping sick people when dropping people when they get sick. We're trying through this legislation to set a new system of rules that will prevent them from behaving this way. I understand a lot of people just don't believe that they'll ever change. My hope is that if we can get good regulation, get a new system of rules, that they can become good citizens. A lot of people don't believe it. That's why they want the public option. I think we have to have strong regulation. That's our best bet at this point in order to correct these abuses.
It is amazing. Every now and then you just stop and think, don't you, Paul, what you just said, avoiding sick people, dropping people who get sick. You wonder why we haven't, and not everybody does that, but so many people do insurance companies that you wonder why there hasn't been an outrage about this and a call for a basic change years and years ago. That's quite a remarkable thing to say.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's there have been so many efforts over the years, and the interests involved are enormous. But it's not just interests that have been involved. It's also touches Americans on very sensitive questions. We are more divided in this country about health care than are any of the other countries that we usually think of as being most like us. Health care is really not as ideological an issue in any of the other major democracies. That's really quite remarkable. The other day, Senator Orrin Hatch said there would be a holy war. That was his phrase, a holy war over this legislation in Congress. Now, I can understand why he disagrees with it, why he's opposed to it. What I find really remarkable about the state of American politics today compared to these other countries is the level of the rhetoric, the intensity, the why has healthcare become such a volatile issue? And I don't think it's inherent in healthcare. I think it's because of what's happened in the past, how it's gotten built up ideologically. But that's where we are now.
And why would, I know that we don't have him at the table at the moment, but why would Senator Hatch describe this as a holy war? Well, how can that resonate with anybody?
I guess he feels it must resonate with many of the people who agree with him. And I think there is a part of the Republican base out there that feels that way. That has made it into that kind of a cause. So, you know, and I have to say that I have some passion invested on the other side, and many other supporters of healthcare reform are pretty passionate about it too. So we've all gotten to this point where temperatures are way higher than they should be.
Right. But what gets me is that it's something that's so common to all of us. We all have sickness. We all know people in our families, and we are but one job away from probably being uninsured ourselves. Mm-hmm. We know people who have been dropped by insurance companies. Everybody does, no matter what your political persuasion. It's common to all of us. We're all going to die. We all have to make decisions about end-of-life care and end-of-life procedures. So it's hard for me to understand why there's all this rancor about something that's so basically human.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, American politics is rancorous today. I think it's just an example of where we are.
And it was in 1994 on this issue as well, as you well know.
Yes, it was. But, you know, if you look back further, that hasn't always been the case. We were very close in the early 1970s to reaching an agreement on national health insurance. And in retrospect, the differences between the plan that Ted Kennedy supported and that Richard Nixon supported, those differences were trivial. And it is a tragedy that we didn't work out those differences at that time. And I think if we had done that, it wouldn't be as much of an ideological issue today. We'd be arguing about, you know, different provisions and, you know, how big the copays should be or the deductibles or whatever, and temperatures would not be as high.
If Teddy Kennedy and Richard Nixon can work out something, we ought to be able to do something now, don't you think? That's amazing. Thanks, Roger, for your call. Kelly from Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I've been tuned in for a while, and I guess I haven't heard the word preventative health care, you know, thrown around, or proactive approach to health care versus reactive. And as somebody who is uninsured, I get sick, and I wait, and I wait, and I wait, and I wait. And then I get really sick and go to the emergency room, and the price is super inflated, and I don't see why people aren't more on board with the preventative versus reactive healthcare, because I think that would be beneficial to all in terms of, you know, contagions too, like your own health, like, you know, having sick people walking around you, where if people just had their checkups every year and were more preventative, I guess, in the sense of being sick, I think it would be beneficial to all. So I guess it's just a comment that I haven't heard anybody talk about yet.
Thank you, Kelly.
Paul? Well, I certainly agree with Kelly. I mean, that and this legislation is for her. I mean, it's for people who are deferring care when they should be getting it, who aren't getting the preventive measures that do work. There's going to be, you know, a clear benefit to people in Kelly's position if this passes.
Right. Thank you very much for the call. Well, this was an interesting hour. Thank you, Paul, so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Professor Paul Starr, our guest, professor of sociology and public affairs and Stewart professor of communications and public affairs at Princeton University, co-editor of The American Prospect, has written tons of articles on healthcare and media issues, and is author of Freedom's Power, now available in paperback, The History and Promise of Liberalism. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production in our studios here in Milwaukee. A couple good hours. It's amazing how the issue of the week, healthcare, has been replaced by Afghanistan, at least for now. There are so many big issues on the table. Simply a reminder that WPR has a special, it's a national public radio special tonight on Afghanistan from 6 until 7. The host, Linda Wertheimer, will have NPR political and national security correspondents in studio, plus excerpts of testimony given today before members of Congress by Senator Clinton, by the Secretary of Defense, and by the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Thank you for your calls. Thanks for listening. We'll be with you again tomorrow. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.